But right. So I'm here to talk to you about sort of the new catalog release, what we call GWTC2, the Gravitational Wave Transient Catalog 2. This is the LIGO Virgo Kagra Collaboration's second catalog that they've released. There's this mesmerizing little animation here. We have 50 systems that we've detected so far. So as much as I like watching these things go around and around, I do have some other things that I want to show you guys. In particular, my take on sort of using these systems as laboratories for nuclear physics. What I'm really going to focus on is the first half of my talk is going to be, as Neil said, a brief overview of the events that we have, the new detections in particular. And I'm going to use that to motivate some of my recent work to sort of at least show one example of how we can take these catalogs and spin off and try to learn about fundamental physics. I'm looking at nuclear physics here in this example. Instead of just having a butterfly collection of these nice spinning graphics, what else we can learn with these things. So let's dive into it. And again, please remember, questions at any time are welcome. So right, this is sort of the big news. We have these GWTC2 releases. There were four papers that came out, so these first four that I've listed here. There's the actual catalog. This is the list of events and parameter estimations, so posterior distributions for the masses, distances, all that stuff. That's where this is sort of reported. And the second paper I'm going to focus on today is this population properties. So the reason I've picked these two are sort of because they have positive statements. And positive isn't quite the right word. Here we have learned something new or gotten something new rather than just put a tighter upper limit or constraint. So the two other papers, and this is no statement about them, they're both great reads and have lots of good physics in them, are tests of general relativity. You probably would have heard about this already, but we have not detected any significant deviation from general relativity. So this paper is a bunch of different ways that people have looked at trying to get at possible deviations from general relativity, and they find that nothing is statistically significant. So take a read through that when you get a chance. The other paper that came out at the same time is a search for gravitational waves in coincidence with gamma ray bursts detected by Fermi and Swift. And in this particular observing run, we did not see anything particularly statistically significant. So those papers are really great, but I don't really have time in an hour talk to go through even one of these papers in full detail. So I'm gonna cherry pick a few things from these. That being said, there is going to be a strong gravity group meeting about an hour and a half after this talk ends, where we're going to talk about all these. So you can either ask me your really hard questions now, or I'll join for that call, and you can also ask us your really hard questions then. Additionally, if you don't want to ask me your really hard questions, there are going to be a series of webinars that the LVK, LIGO Virgo Kagra Collaboration, has put together. The first one is tomorrow, November 5th at 10 a.m. Eastern time in the U.S. So that's 10 a.m. for people local in Waterloo. You can register at this URL. It is ungodly long, but either take a screenshot. I'm going to put this back up at the end of the talk too, when we're talking about more general questions. But you can register here. Everyone's welcome. Again, this is the first of a series that are going to happen once a week, sort of as we work through these papers. And the webinars will be led by people mostly who actually wrote the words in the draft, even though a lot of these analyses combine work from many different people in the collaboration. So there are people who have really had their hands up to the elbows and all this stuff for a long time. You can listen to them talk about it as well starting tomorrow. Okay, so let's dive in. I've highlighted these two papers again, the actual catalog paper and then population properties paper, as these are what we're going to start off with, or at least motivate some of my personal work with. So the first thing is O3, right? This is the third observing run. What's new? And the main thing that's new is the detectors. So I've focused on the LIGO detectors here. I just want to say it from up front. Virgo saw similar improvements. Virgo is a great instrument. I'm just focusing on a specific paper that went into some detail about the performance of the LIGOs during this. And the main thing that we have is just increased sensitivity. So the detectors are more sensitive. They can see systems that are quieter or further away. And this really means that we're able to see more things in the universe. So one way you can see this is the x-axis here is weeks. So this is weeks into the run. Each dot here is a different estimate of the range at a different day. So it's a function of time. Blue is the Livingston detector. Red is the Hanford detector. And you can immediately see that Livingston tends to be more sensitive than Hanford. But both of them are pretty consistently above 100 megaparsecs. For people who aren't familiar with these distance scales, 1 megaparsec is roughly the distance to the nearest galaxy outside of the Milky Way. So we're talking about 100 times as far as that. And this range is specifically the average distance at which you would be able to confidently detect a binary neutron star system. So there are other measures for heavier systems that you might want to use. This is a typical, gestalt, just intuitive measure that people like to quote. This number is the binary neutron star average angle average range. On the right here, you can see if you take all these nice little, time-dependent dots on the left, and you just make a histogram, you get these two distributions. And you can see, as you would expect, Livingston tends to be more sensitive than Hanford in this run. That's great. But the real thing that you can see is on the bottom here, I've annotated what the sort of the characteristic range from O2 was at Livingston, and it was 88 megaparsecs. So we're going from 88 megaparsecs to something like 130, 135. Typically, there are sometimes that are longer, sometimes that are, closer in. Hanford's characteristic O2 range was actually off the X scale of this plot. It was somewhere over here around like 60. So both detectors have gotten markedly more sensitive. And this is great. So it's really this increase in sensitivity that's driving everything. Another way to look at this is the time volume that we have surveyed. So if you're not familiar with this unit, this is, basically the space-time volume that you were sensitive to in cubic gigaparsecs times year, which is a little bit of a funny unit. But the rate estimates that we usually have are just in the inverse of this. So if you have some theoretical calculation that predicts, how often binary neutron stars should merge, usually that number is given in per cubic gigaparsec per year. So if you take this number, and it's just how long you ran your detector and how sensitive you were while you ran that detector, that gives you an immediate idea of how many events you should detect. So in O1, O2, you can see it's ticking up. In O2, or Livingston, the blue line starts to tick up a little faster than Hanford. But in an O3, they both take an energy pill, and they start skyrocketing. So the fact that the slope here is much, much steeper is just a statement that the range was bigger. But you can also see that most of the VT that we've surveyed in the entire advanced detector era is coming from O3, this newest one. So most of the events that we're seeing, we would expect to come from O3. And that is, in fact, what has happened. So we really have seen an explosion in the number of events compared to all of this O1 and O2 previously. The other thing to note is that the blue line is above the red line pretty much all the time. So this means that Livingston really is the most sensitive detector. It has been for a while, and it's what's driving our detection. So Livingston is sort of the SNR machine. It's where you are getting most of your signal-to-noise ratio for most of the events. So the hope is that Livingston has learned how to make itself really, really sensitive. And there's no reason, no intrinsic reason why Hanford can't be as sensitive. So we can take all the things that we've learned about Livingston and sort of try to copycat that and put it here at Hanford, and we'll get the curve up near the blue curve as soon as we can. That's going to have to wait till O4, but this is the basic idea here, is that we'll have two curves up here, extreme sensitivity.
Wait, so Reid, oh yeah, so does this curve mean like the volume that each detector is sensitive to without using the other one?
That is correct. So right now, these two curves are as if you only had a Livingston or you only had a Hanford. In reality, what you're going to do is you're going to analyze all the data that you have, and when you have both detectors on, you will be slightly more sensitive than you would if you had only one detector on, basically. So the effective range that you would get from sort of combining these two will be a little bit higher than what you would get from just looking at Livingston. But the fact that Livingston is significantly more sensitive than Hanford means that it's still driving sort of your ultimate range, your ultimate sensitivity.
So Reed, is there any particular technology that you can put your finger onto that is different in Livingston than Hanford that might cause this difference?
Yeah, so there has been a lot of work on laser power and sort of alignment between O2 and O3. So the idea is if you have more power circulating in your arm, your interferometer arms, that gives you essentially a bigger signal. You have more photons that are sensitive to the induced strain. So you can read out a smaller signal because you have a bigger magnifying glass, if you want to say it that way. Livingston has historically been able to put in a bit of a higher laser amplifier, in particular with O3. Hanford has had some other issues. At the end of O2 in particular, there was a big earthquake that misaligned some things. So the alignment between the optics has, I think, just by happenstance been a little more finicky at Hanford. So a lot of the power has been, a lot of the increase in sensitivity is associated with this laser power. Also a little bit the better seismic isolation that people have been continuously working on. And then the last thing that really helped a lot is that people have installed baffles or light dumps, laser dumps. So these are very absorptive materials, meaning that if you have scattered light somewhere in the interferometer and it hits one of these things, it doesn't reflect, it just gets absorbed. And they put a bundle of those in Livingston. They put some in Hanford as well, but I'm pretty sure that they put more in Livingston. And this has gotten rid of a lot of scattered light that tended to rattle around and overall increase the noise floor. So if that's the case, right, then Hanford, you can just add more of those things and you should catch back up. It's one of the nice things about having these two sites is you can play off of each other. And there is a sizable fraction of the community that is focused on doing that. Okay, great. So good questions. Please do keep them coming. Let's get away from just the detectors and talk about the actual events. So in GWTC2, this is the catalog release, there are 39 new candidates presented, and these are selected with a false alarm rate that must be less than 2 per year, or less than 1 every 6 months. And just to be absolutely clear, what this means is that the probability that noise in the detector alone could be responsible for the candidate must be such that would only happen in once per 6 months of data recorded. And with this threshold chosen and the amount of data that was analyzed in just 3A part, you would expect from a basic counting experiment, something like 3 false positives. So that was about the target that was chosen for this false alarm rate, a contamination of roughly 10%. So 3 out of 40 is, we're consistent with what we're shooting for. If you want a cleaner sample, you can just up the false alarm rate threshold. All the false alarm rates for all events are publicly available, so you can then down select whatever you want. All of these posterior samples, to make these curves, they're all publicly available, so you can do whatever you want. 26 of these events were found in the latency, 13 were reported here for the first time. The catalog paper goes into, why these 13 may not have been found in low latency in some detail. We can talk about that if you want. Personally, I think it's just more interesting to look at where these things tend to fall. So I'm plotting here the total mass of the system versus the mass ratio. There are a few different ones that are called out in colored lines, but the main group is all these grayish black lines that like to live near total masses between say 20 and like 70, and at mass ratios consistent with 1. So this is what we would call at this point a vanilla binary black hole, which is, it's still amazing to me that the first detection was 5 years ago, almost, maybe a month, 5 years and 1 month or so ago. And we're already, to the point where many of the black holes detecting are bored. They just look like the stuff that we've seen. So the fact that things are grouping here is just sort of a happy accident between where we're most sensitive. So we can see bigger systems further away because they produce bigger gravitational waves. So you are sensitive to a larger volume with higher mass systems. But intrinsically, these high mass systems are also rarer. The universe makes fewer of them. So that tends to produce this little peak in the observed distribution that lives in this region. That's why most of the detected things are living there. That being said, there are some interesting sort of things towards the tail. You can see the colored ellipses, ovals, bananas, whatever you want to call them. Those tend to live near the edge of this black clumping. The 1905-21 results, so this was the most recent exceptional event published. This guy is really big, whopping, the biggest thing that we've seen so far. It's over here at relatively high masses. I should mention that these masses are done with what we call the default prior. There is going to be a talk tomorrow, a seminar, at I believe 2 p.m. primitive time, but by some authors who are not in the LVK, but they reanalyze this data and they're finding some different conclusions with different priors. So if you're interested in really heavy, massive BBHs, definitely tune in for that. There are also some light things. So we have binary neutron stars that we published separately, some possible neutron star black holes, NSBHs, that live in this sort of triangle region. This guy I've called out because I'm going to come back to him a couple times throughout the rest of the talk, 1908-14. It's a very sort of extreme mass ratio. I'm using that term a little incorrectly. The mass ratio is around 0.1, so 10 to 1, a little bit bigger than that. And the secondary mass, the smaller mass, is right around the biggest that you would ever think is possible for a neutron star. So this guy is interesting for many different reasons. I do want to mention that there's this other event, 1904-26, that if it's real, it would fall directly in the NSBH region. This would be a very confident detection. Unfortunately, the false alarm rate for this guy is one of the higher ones that we have in the catalog. So if you're requiring a pure sample and throw away things with a relatively high FAR, you're going to get rid of this guy first. So if it's a very interesting detection, it's an NSBH definitely. But it could just be a noise fluctuation. It's just simply very, very quiet and not confident enough to say. So we have this bundle of new events. And what can we do with it? As I mentioned, there's a lot that we can do with it, and there's a lot that is published in the collection of papers that I just don't have time to talk about. I'm going to focus on the rates and populations results, and even in that one paper, there's a lot that I just don't have time to talk about. But one thing that I think is interesting to look at is the mass distribution. So we are learning a lot more about the mass distribution, in particular sort of the massive black holes and how they behave. So this is a figure from that paper. And in that paper, they consider four different models. So the goal here, just to state it plainly, is to take the catalog, the whole set of detections that you have, and try to figure out how nature likes to distribute black holes throughout the universe. Do they like to be a particular mass? Do they like to be spinning at a certain rotation rate, et cetera, et cetera? How are they distributed from us in redshift? All that stuff is what the target of this paper is. And they go through many, many different types of things to look at correlations between mass and spin, redshift evolution, the binary rate follow star formation. All these things are described in quite some detail in this paper. I'm just going to look at sort of the shape of the mass distribution. So does nature like to make really massive things or really light things? And previous analyses used a simple power law that was truncated, so it had sort of sharp cutoffs, infinitely sharp cutoffs. And this paper then looks at a couple different models in addition to that. So they look at the same truncated power law. So this is a power law with a sharp cutoff. They look at a broken power law, a power law with a Gaussian peak, and a power law with two peaks. And the main thing that you see is, yes, there are differences between the models. I can distinguish this red curve from the green curve. But overall, the general trend is the same. It's something like a power law here. Lighter things are intrinsically more common. They're more often made in the universe than really, really massive things. But the additional feature that we're seeing in these three models that have more freedom is that there's a bit of a kink. And it's a little hard to see in the broken power law here. But in the peak, the power law plus peak, there's this preference for some sort of spike or peak or some sort of feature here you can see that something's going on. And I've indicated these all with black arrows. So in previous analyses, in 01-02, with this truncated model, there was evidence for the sharp cutoff landing around 40 solar masses. Well, now we've seen things, excuse me, that are significantly heavier than that. So what that means is that this sharp truncation is no longer really a good match for the data. But perhaps it's not surprising that an infinitely sharp truncation in the mass distribution doesn't actually model what nature does perfectly. Like, it's probably likely that something more complicated was going on. So we do find—
Reed, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Please go ahead.
So are those redshift corrected masses, or are those incorporating the redshift and, you know, well, depending on what you answer, I'll have a follow-up, I guess.
Very good question, Eric. What I'm plotting here are the source frame masses. So you would have to take this, apply the factor of 1 plus z to get the masses that we see in the detector frame. These should be the intrinsic mass distributions that are that nature produces in the source frame throughout cosmological time.
Okay, so so accounting for the redshift introduces, I would guess, a substantial error in the mass estimate.
Yes. So the chirp mass, which is the best measured parameter, that does get significantly broader because you have this 1 plus z that comes from the distance uncertainty. It turns out that for many systems, the uncertainty in the component masses doesn't get that much worse because you don't know the mass ratio that well. But you're absolutely right. There's less uncertainty in the masses in the source frame than there is in the detector frame.
Thank you.
I have a question. You say here, do you tell me 19.0521 fits well within these models? Not necessarily an outlier. So what about the pair stability issue, which cuts off black hole masses above 40 solar mass?
So I'm sorry, my audio was a little quiet, John. I think I heard what you said, so please ask again if I don't answer the correct question. Right, there's the new fits that include the O3, they have these tails to high masses, right? And then they just have some feature in this distribution, like it's very obvious where there's Gaussians, like there's a little peak that you can just pick out. Yeah. And then there's where the break is in the power law. Those all like to be right around 40 solar masses, which is roughly where theory predicts this pair instability or pulsational pair instability thing would kick in and prevent you from making bigger stars. So one of the possible interpretations of this result is that the pair instability supernova is not infinitely sharp, but it does create, you know, at higher masses, a rapid drop off. So it's much steeper over here than sort of it is over here. It's not as obvious in the broken power law as it is, say, in this multi-peak model. You know, there's a much sharper drop off here than, say, right over here. So maybe that one interpretation is that's what's going on. There is some feature, and then it's just a very sharp tail rather than something smooth. These y-axes are logarithmic, so this does correspond to a pretty sharp drop off. That being said, it could also be that there's something going on here that we don't understand. Many people have published on hierarchical merger channels where you would take two things formed below the parent stability, and then you can throw them together and remerge them, and then you could maybe make something that's bigger there. I think the fairest thing to say is we don't really know yet, but if you just take the naive thing and say, does this model reproduce all the observations that we've seen yet, this overall total mass distribution, the answer is yes. It will fit 19.05.21 without too much of an issue. Part of the reason for that is that 19.05.21 is not the only guy that we've seen in these tails. We've actually seen two or three other people who tend to be in this tail above sort of this kink feature. So the fact that there's this long tail out here is not driven by a single event. So if you remove that single event, you still get roughly consistent behavior. So my apologies, John. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks. I don't want to take up your time, but I have another quick question regarding 521. It's observed at 30 hertz. Also, the observation time is 0.1 seconds. And so you get about four cycles at merging. So at 30 hertz, you start getting into noise problems, seismic noise, light scattering, da da da. So are we actually sure that they've taken account of enough account of the noise there and the analysis?
Yeah, so they explicitly fit all of that noise. So there are assumptions about the basically the spectral characteristics of that noise, in that you can model it as a stationary Gaussian process. That's a technical detail. But that is included in all the analyses. There was quite a bit of, at least internally within the collaborations, there was quite a bit of hand-wringing about whether or not we've done that. So locally around the event, they measured the noise immediately surrounding the event. And then so the assumption is that the characteristics of the noise in the detector are not going to vary over a time scale, you know, comparable to the duration of the event, so 0.1 seconds, which is, that's probably fair. That matches with the characteristics of noise we've seen elsewhere.
A 0.1 second, you don't expect it to be Gaussian. If you make that assumption, it's questionable.
So I'm going to disagree with you there. I think over that time scale, the detector noise is well represented by a Gaussian. There are these things we call glitches that I would argue are really manifest as additional signals on top of a stationary Gaussian noise background. But this is getting a little bit into the weeds. Please do ask me again at the end of the talk.
Thank you.
Okay, so one of the main conclusions that we have is that looking at this high mass behavior, we're able to pick up on this tail, right? So this interesting tail behavior. There is a kink, there is something going on, but we think maybe our understanding of the parent stability mass gap from the gravitation wave data is certainly evolving. So sort of the high mass behavior is evolving. I'm saying high mass and parent stability mass gap. People talk about this as the upper mass gap. But there's also a question of what people have talked about as the lower mass gap, so sort of at these low masses. And if you look at just these plots up here, you can see that the mass distribution rolls off. So it's telling you that there's some mass below which black holes tend not to form. That's sort of what the model is telling you. And you can ask the question, well, what is that minimum mass scale? And that's what I've highlighted down here. The shaded things are when you fit everything without 1908-14. The dashed lines are when you fit it with 1908-14. And you can see that the distributions shift. So they're not inconsistent. You know, the shaded things do have some support way down here, but they're broad and they kind of like to be at higher masses. Higher masses here is like 7. Whereas when you include 1908-14, that changes a lot. So this, in addition to a few other things, really leads this paper to conclude that 1908-14 is an outlier. So the conclusion is that 0521 fits these models just fine, but 1908-14 is not being adequately captured by sort of the low mass behavior that is allowed in these models. And this type of a plot where you're seeing a lot of shift when you just remove or add one event, that's one of the things that's motivating that statement. There's another event that has a sort of interesting mass ratio. 1904-12, this had a mass ratio of about 4:1. It was a 30 plus an 8 solar mass star. It turns out that this system does seem to fit that mass ratio tail or distribution that sort of isn't, I'm not showing that the degree of freedom here, but it's baked into these models as well. That seems to fit that quite well, or it should be part of that population. It's really only this guy that is an outlier. So if you read this paper, this race and population paper, keep an eye out. You'll see they mentioned this several times. Most of the fits they present exclude 1908-14 because they think it's not well captured by these models, which then begs the question, okay, what's going on with this event? So with the rest of my paper...
Sorry, Reed, for this statement that it's an outlier, that must be prior dependent, right? You know, because these distributions seem very broad. So what prior was assumed, I guess, for this M-min parameter?
Yeah, so MMIM here, the prior that was assumed was minimum in both cases. The prior on MMIN in both cases, either with and without 1908-14, was assumed to be uniform. So flat.
The flat in, okay, okay, I see.
Flat that. In MMIN, right?
So right, if you use like a log prior, for example, instead of like a linear prior, presumably, Yeah, I see. Okay, so these statements, I guess, are still, rather uncertain.
Yeah, so like you could take some sort of mass distribution like this, tweak the prior on these hyperparameters, and move these two posteriors, like with and without the event, closer or further away. That's absolutely the case. One of the other types of checks, I'm not showing it here, but one thing that they have typically done is you do your analysis with some hyperprior on these parameters, and then you say, okay, I believe this is my uncertainty about the mass distribution. I'm now going to simulate a bunch of detections drawn from that uncertainty in the mass distribution and see how likely it is that I would ever detect something with the, you know, the secondary mass as small as this. And so that is a little less susceptible to the priors in some extent. It's more like a frequentist cross-check, if you want to use that language. And typically 1908-14, with, you know, seeing something as small as that is quite rare if you don't include it in the fits. So that's there are many different ways we try to quantify that. The paper does a much better job than just pointing at this figure with a little arrow on it. So I would encourage you to read that. I apologize, I don't have the numbers memorized right now, but that's the type of thing that we're looking at.
Okay, great, thanks.
Okay, great, okay. So hopefully I've now piqued your interest about this guy, 1908-14. I'm sure people have talked about it before. Here are the masses that are sort of inferred for this event. It turns out to be pretty loud, this event. So we get the masses reasonably well as being around 23 solar masses and around 2.6 solar masses. And those change a little bit depending on the waveform model. So the model based on GR that you use, and a little bit based on the mass distribution that you assume. So which one of these models or whatever at low densities, you would assume you can push this posterior around a little bit, but actually not that much. It's a pretty informative. So how are we going to, you know, make progress on this guy? He doesn't seem to fit in the normal BBH population. So what are we going to do? And my proposal is basically to try to answer three questions. What can we learn about nuclear physics from neutron star observations? Can we make progress on understanding this mass distribution at low low masses? So this interesting range, is there a low mass gap? If there is, what can we say about its parameters? And then finally, sort of as a very practical consideration, can we just tell whether something is a neutron star or a black hole? You know, like how do we take all of our knowledge and answer a very straightforward question? Is this thing, this M2 that's at 2.6, is that a neutron star or does it have to be a black hole? You know, what can we say based on the physics that we understand? So I'm going to run through these three questions, which again are primarily motivated by sort of considerations of 1914 and the types of behavior we're seeing from the full GWTC2 catalog. But some of the data that I'm using here is you know, pre-existing papers, so they're not the most up-to-date analyses given you know, that the data became public less than a week ago. Okay, so let's first talk about how we learn about the equation of state. So I'm specifically gonna talk about some work that I've been doing over the past few years about non-parametric equation of state inference. And I just wanna call out, I have a bunch of collaborators, but in particular, many people here probably know Phil Landry, who got his PhD with Eric at Guelph. So Phil and I have been working on this for quite some time. And this paper actually, as of today, this archive number is out of date. It just got published in PRC and it's the editor's suggestion. So if you go to the PRC homepage, you'll see this paper thrown at you. The idea here is to take, you know, what we observe about neutron stars and try to learn about the nuclear microphysics that makes them up. So the pressure and the density and the cores of these objects. And we want to do it in a non-parametric way, which is a fancy way of saying we want to make as few assumptions as possible. We really want the data to speak out as loudly as possible so that we can make sure we're not tricking ourselves by building in some sort of subtle prior dependence, much like the stuff that Neil was asking about earlier. So just as a quick review, the types of things that we observe about neutron stars are the macroscopic properties. So I really want to know in this cartoon, what are the vertex strengths in this Feynman diagram, right? Like what are the actual interactions in my Lagrangian that describes the particles inside this neutron star? But I can't directly observe those. So I can observe things about the neutron star and then try to do some sort of inverse inference. So the first thing you can look at is how big the neutron stars are. And that's because the equation state will only support neutron stars up to a certain mass scale. Beyond that, they must collapse to black holes. So that fact is going to come up a lot more and when we talk about the analysis of 1908-14. But basically, the idea is if you go out and you confirm that you see something that's really big, heavy, and you know it's a neutron star, then you know the equation of states must be relatively stiff, and you've learned something, because it has to be able to support something. But the caveat there is you need to be confident that it is, in fact, a neutron star. Like, you need to see surface emission, you need to see pulses, something like that. In the gravitation wave signals that we see, this would turn into, you know, some sort of matter effects that would imprint. If you don't see this confidently, you can't actually demand that it's a neutron star. You need to check it for consistency with other things. The other types of observables that we use are mass and radius. So the new kid on the block doing this type of measurement is NICER. I'm sure people have heard a lot about this, X-ray pulsar timing. So you try to measure the radius and the mass simultaneously. If you do this at a couple different mass scales, you can sort of map out the equation of state. And that's the science goal of that mission. Gravitational waves do something similar, but instead of the physical extent, the actual radius of the neutron star, they're measuring what's called the tidal deformability. So the idea here is when the neutron star is in a binary, the binary companion exerts a tidal field. And just like the moon will raise tides on the Earth, that squishes the neutron star, it deforms it a little bit. And the degree of the squishiness of the neutron star is characterized by this lambda parameter. And you can measure that directly with gravitational waves. So we're going after this lambda as a function of mass in gravitational waves. And again, when you map that out for a couple different mass scales, you can figure out roughly what the stellar structure of these neutron stars are, and therefore the equation of state from that. So these are the main observables we're going to use. You'll see these types of things in these color codes show up in the rest of the talk. But just to jump right into it, these are sort of the cutting edge constraints on the equation of states. This is what we understand about what the matter inside neutron stars is doing. In the top left here, I have the pressure versus the density, and the bottom right, the mass versus the radius. A lot of people are used to thinking about our uncertainty in the radius at different mass scales, so that's why this is useful. Here, this is more of a microphysical picture that I've been trying to motivate. So we start off, this is a completely agnostic analysis, so we condition on theory in only the minimal way possible. And you can see that in these black lines, these are our priors. And we have, you know, particularly at high densities, so to the right of this plot, we have uncertainties in the pressures that are many orders of magnitude. So we're making very, very few assumptions about what's going on here inside the neutron star. And additionally, we make few assumptions about the correlations between pressures at different densities. So we're really trying to explore as many different types of behaviors as we can here. And that's manifest in this very broad prior. When you add pulsar observations, you're basically saying, you know, well, I've seen something that's pretty big, which means that the pressure has to get pretty big to support it against gravitational collapse. So that cuts out this part of the prior over here. And you can see the light blue actually, you know, is pushed to high pressures at high densities and throws out all this part of the prior. When you add gravitational waves, it turns out gravitational waves tend to like softer things. That's just what the data is suggesting, particularly between nuclear density and twice nuclear density. So sort of the green curve is cutting out this part. The light blue goes from the green or to the green. And then you can actually see it's actually supporting relatively soft things, softer than you might have thought with just the pulsars. But still at high densities, the pulsars win, and you just have to get big and strong and have high pressure at some point. The last trend that tends to happen is the nicer data comes in, and the nicer data tends to not like really, really small radii. So it throws out these very, very soft equations of state, and you go from the green to the blue here. And really the combination that we're seeing is that the nicer data is limiting down here, gravitational wave data is limiting up here, pulsar data is limiting right here, and this top part is actually just causality that the sound speed has to be less than the speed of light. And so we're pinched from this relatively big fat prior that assumed very, very little about the equation state to this blue region. And you can look and you say, that's great, you've learned a lot. But you can also look at it and say, well, you know, what is the uncertainty in the pressure at, say, twice nuclear density? And it's still nearly an order of magnitude. So we don't have a precision measurement yet, but we're hopefully on our way. And the analysis that I've led of this type of, you know, this type of approach is really trying to make sure that we get to the right equation of state and don't have some sort of subtle model bias or modeling that's going in. I'm not gonna run through it, but we can see the similar behavior in the mass radius curve where pulsars like stiff things, gravitation waves like soft things, and you can sort of get pinched with nicer to the sort of stuff that's right in the middle. So the one thing that you might notice is that I said I'm conditioning on theory information in sort of the minimal way, but we are at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. So there's the question of, can you include theory and do better? And this is the paper that I highlighted that, that really tries to do that. So we took a particular calculation, a nuclear theoretic calculation, and said, what if we believe that with the uncertainty estimates that it quotes, and we believe that at low density, sort of where it's tested against terrestrial experiments and sort of, you know, data that we think that we know. And then at some point we stop trusting it and we go back to this completely agnostic, do whatever you want model at very high densities. Okay, that's great. You can certainly do that. But the additional thing is you can change that transition density when you stop trusting it to stop trusting it at very high densities or at very low densities, and you get this sort of set of nested priors. You then hit that with the astrophysical data. And again, I've called out sort of where pulsars nicer and gravitational waves are dominating. The main thing that you see is the posteriors all tend to fall on top of each other. So there are differences between when you stop trusting theory. There's more apparent down here. But for the most part, you're getting pretty much the same answer. And, you know, it's a tight result. You know, it's still a factor of a few. It's not percent level, but that's great. But the additional thing that lets you do is it lets you ask the question, does the data, the astrophysical data, actually like the theory up to twice nuclear saturation? Or in fact, is it telling you that something different is going on, something that the theory does not predict happen at a lower density? So maybe your theory is starting to break down. And as far as I know, we're the first ones to quantify this in any great detail. And that's exactly what we do. So in this plot, we see on the x-axis the density up to which you trust nuclear theory. And the y-axis here is something like the posterior, how much the data likes that. So if you go to higher values here, the data likes it more and more. And what this plot is showing you is that the pulsar and gravitation wave data like the particular nuclear theory calculation we used up, and as high as you want to trust it, it just likes it more and more. That doesn't have to be the case, but it just does say that basically that the theory is doing a good job of predicting what the data is telling you. To show you that doesn't have to be the case, we made two different fake theories that did something different at high densities, and they start doing something different around nuclear saturation. So if you can pick up on interesting density scales, you should see some behavior begin to change around nuclear saturation. Turn the crank, that's exactly what you see. So the colorful curves here break away from the black thing around nuclear saturation, so you're able to infer something about the density scale at which your theory is breaking down, because I've made these theories do something wacky at that point. When you throw in nicer data, things change a little bit. The black curve actually now has a local maximum. Maybe it's starting to break down. Maybe it's starting to break down around nuclear saturation. What do you infer though? What is missing in this black calculation? Well, one possibility is that this is an effective field theory calculation. Maybe I haven't gone through enough orders in that effective field theory. The blue calculation here is at a higher order in exactly the same effective field theory, and it seems to be preferred more than the black when you include nicer. So this suggests that possibly the higher order terms in the effective field theory are becoming important at higher densities. That makes sense because most of these higher order terms are many body interactions, which should become more important at higher densities. So when you include those in the calculation, you go from the black to the blue, and maybe that's what's going on here, is this black calculation simply isn't high enough order in the theory.
So Reid?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Luis.
So on this, the calculation you're doing with respect to gravitational waves, you're just computing the tidal law numbers with your mock-up equation of state. Is that the only thing that goes through from the point of view of gravitational waves and your base estimate?
That's exactly right. So here, basically, I have a bunch of different EOS realizations. So I have some prior process. So for each draw from that prior, I get an equation of state, which will follow the theory up until I tell it to stop following the theory, and then it will do whatever it wants, like some random process. For that equation of state, I compute the sequence of stellar models for mass, radius, lambda, whatever, and then I compare the consistency of that sequence of stellar models, the mass, radius curves, mass, lambda curves, with astrophysical observations to figure out how likely that equation of state is to
And you assume a distribution of sources, or do you pick golden sources to do this calculation?
So we basically have golden sources right now, because those are the only ones that we've actually seen that are informative enough. So 170817 for gravitational waves is a pretty golden source. Also the nicer observations are sort of, they cherry picked what they were going to point at to have an idea of what they were looking at. But we do assume things like a mass distribution for how these neutron stars are distributed in the universe, all sort of the stuff that I was talking about earlier with the Rates and Pops paper. Those types of assumptions also go into this. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
So question I have is, so you select the chiral effective field theory. Is it because, you know, as far as you know, there's a strong consensus on the nuclear physics community that that this is the best that they can give you?
So the our selection process for what theory we used is less well modeled than, say, our selection process for what black holes we think we'll detect in the universe. We mostly used EFT because of our collaborators. So the people who wrote this paper with me are experts on EFT calculations. But the other thing that's very nice about the EFT calculations that come out of the nuclear physics community right now is they come equipped with error estimates. So let me see. Yeah, this is a great segue. Thank you, Eric. I couldn't have planned this more. The priors that I'm showing here have some width. And the width here is not actually set by me or anything like that. It's actually coming directly from the theory calculation. So they truncate their calculation in a particular order, and then they try to quantify robustly the error associated with that truncation. And that gives them some spread. So the EFT approach, the effective field theory approach, lends itself to that nicely, which means instead of just a point estimate from, you know, someone who thinks that they have the best Lagrangian, they're able to give us, you know, error bars on all their predictions, which meshes very nicely with our approach of trying to, you know, put up a prior process and well understood error bars that don't have subtle modeling systematics baked in. So that was the main reason, but there's no reason you couldn't do this with whatever theory you wanted. It's just going to take a few more compute cycles.
I take it that those theories have been calibrated against countless measurements of nuclear, you know, structures and
it's primarily
from low to high mass. And
it's primarily low mass nuclei, the masses of low mass nuclei, but also some scattering data. I'm not an expert on all of what it is, but yes, that's exactly right. So they calibrate the EFT low energy coefficients to terrestrial experiments and things like that. And then this is a bit of an extrapolation from that. You know, you can fit all the effective interactions to match those observations, and then you propagate that to higher densities. And our question is, when does that propagation break down? When does it suck?
Okay, thank you. I think this is awesome, by the way. I mean, this is really great.
Thank you.
I have a question.
So John, I'm gonna have to ask you to wait. I'm almost out of time and I want to flip through the remaining analyses, but please do ask your question at the end. Okay, great. So we have this analysis and we're learning stuff about the equation of state. It's great. So that's telling you about, you know, how big neutron stars could be. But that doesn't tell you about how big nature likes to make them. So the next thing, and my apologies, I'm running out of time. I'm gonna have to go through this quickly, is this paper that was recently published in MJ Letters. By Maya Fischbach, myself, and Dan Holtz. And the caveat about this is that it only uses O1 and O2 data. That is an artifact of the publication timescale. So this came out before the O3 data was public, and we were just looking at the O1 and O2 data, which begs the question, we need to do an update of this to see how these things change when you have 50 events instead of just 10. But that being said, the idea here is we're going to try to figure out what gravitational waves can tell us about this mass distribution, in particular, whether there's evidence for extra types of features in the low mass range. So this A parameter, sort of the depth of this gap called the low mass gap, and the typical mass scales that we're looking at here, some sort of feature between like 2 and 5 solar masses. So really the low mass end, very relevant for neutron stars, all that stuff. And so this paper tries to figure out, does the data actually say that we need some sort of feature here, whether it could be a gap? We actually allow for the possibility of a bump in sort of this range, but, something besides a smooth power law. And what does that say with respect to the data? So again, this is only O1 and O2. Take that with a grain of salt. But we do start to see hints of something that's interesting. So in this paper, again, only O1 and O2. We analyzed a couple different mass models. And what we're taking here is, a very simple model is just a power law and then adding extra features at the low mass end and saying, does the data like that more? And what you can see is that when you allow for the presence of a dip, instead of demanding that it's a smooth power law, the data does tend to, you know, favor some sort of dip. And it could be a very deep dip. It could be a very shallow dip. And the location of that dip also changes. So there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what this feature would look like. Even the presence of the dip is not certain. The data, again, only all 102, likes the presence of this dip only like a factor of 4 in likelihood relative to no dip at all. So it's definitely not overwhelming proof, but even with the data that we have on hand, maybe we're starting to see that there's some sort of interesting feature going on here. And just to say this one more time in a slightly different way, what we're measuring is the total mass distribution. So I'm not making any assumption about like the stuff down here at very, very low masses has to be neutron stars. That could be primordial black holes that merge for all I know. I'm just trying to say, what is the overall mass distribution of merging systems in the universe? Is there a feature in it that I need the model in order to reproduce my data well? And what we see is as we add more model freedom, the data is kind of saying like, yeah, you know, that's an interesting thing. I kind of like it. It's not an overwhelming preference, but you know, this is a hint of the direction to go. So also one more, actually, I'm just gonna skip this due to time. The main point of this slide is that based on the model that you assume when you fit the population, you will actually get slightly different numbers when you compute the rate. So the expected number of binary black holes versus binary neutron stars, you know, you need to take all those numbers that come out of papers with a grain of salt because they do have modeling assumptions built into them. And again, in GWTC2, so this is the O3 result, these plots show you the shaded regions are the observed distributions, and the light regions are sort of what the predicted models would suggest. And you can see that the observed distribution does have a bunch of interesting features that are sometimes not captured by our models. So if we, you know, if we do a careful analysis, can we find that there need to be more features in sort of the models that we allow to better capture what's actually going on in the mass distribution, particularly at the low mass end? So this paper focused, the actual RNP paper, where this is from, focused a lot on the sort of the high mass end, the parent stability mass feature, which would be here around 40. And the question is, you know, I think we still have more work to do at the low mass end. So briefly, this is just gonna be a lightning review of a paper that Phil and I wrote about connecting it all together, how to actually tell neutron stars apart from black holes. So, okay, great. We've learned about nuclear physics. We can learn about the total mass distribution, but like if I see something like 1908-14, I want to know, should I point a telescope at it? Because is there matter there? Am I gonna see a GRP, et cetera, et cetera? Distinguishing between neutron stars and black holes has many different applications and you wanna be able to do it robustly. So in this paper and what I'm gonna talk about here is how we sort of laid out what are your dominating uncertainties to do this. And the basic idea, the intuition is that you're gonna measure two things. And these are the two things that I just talked about. You're gonna measure the maximum mass, so the neutron stars, the properties of neutron stars. You're also gonna measure the overall mass distribution. And you can sort of measure these things separately. So from things that you're absolutely confident in neutron stars, you can get the maximum mass. And then just from the collection of everything you've seen, you'll get this blue curve, the total mass distribution. Everything to the left of the red line could be a neutron star. Things to the right of the red line sort of have to be black holes. There's some fuzz on that, but that's the basic intuition. So if I measure this red thing and this blue thing pretty well from the data, and then I see something new, how can I figure out whether it's a neutron star or a black hole? And the one thing I want to point out is many people would think that this maximum mass feature would have to be exactly co-located with some sort of kink in the total mass distribution. That doesn't have to be the case. You could have black holes that are formed through some particular supernova fallback mechanism that tend to be just a little bit up too heavy to remain as a neutron star. So you could get a population of things here. A lot of other things could be going on. So we're trying to say, what can we really say based on just these two measurements, the blue and the red thing, and how does that limit us? I'm not gonna be able to go into this in too much detail because of time, but this plot, fortunately, is basically everything you need to know. You're gonna take some sort of measure of the individual object's mass. This is under the assumption that you can't see tidal deformabilities or any sort of like absolutely unambiguous matter signature. So you're just going to look for the masses. You take a measure of the object's mass and you compare that to how big you think neutron stars could be. So we talk about the TOV mass here. This is basically the maximum mass scale. And you have uncertainty in this from your uncertainty in the equation of state. You also have uncertainty in the individual object's mass that comes both from just the finite signal noise ratio. You have some statistical fluctuation, but you also have uncertainty in the total mass distribution, this blue line here. And that would manifest as differences between the solid and the dashed lines up here. So you can see that particularly for this green one, 1904-25, there could be a pretty big difference in your posterior between different population models. So you have to account for that uncertainty as well when you do this. We show how to do this self-consistently in our paper. Turns out to not be as much of a problem for our big boy here, 1908-14, just because it has higher SNR. And then depending on where things fall in this space, you can make your classification. So the top left side here, where the maximum mass is bigger than the mass of the object, that's fine to be a neutron star. It's perfectly fine. If the mass is bigger than the maximum mass, well, you can do that if the neutron star is spinning up to some maximum spin. Beyond that, no neutron star could be supported. It would have had to have collapsed to a black hole, or it would fling itself apart. And so the basic intuition that we see here is that 1904-25, what I've called the probable binary neutron star, is it likes to live in this unshaded region, which, like, this is sort of what we would, depending on your population model, you can see that this solid line will, your exact number will change a little bit, but for the most part, it likes to live over here. Whereas the red guy, 1908-14, which is interesting and motivating a lot of these studies, lives in the most frustrating place possible. It's exactly between non-spinning neutron stars and no neutron stars whatsoever. So it could be a neutron star that's spinning very quickly, or it could be a black hole that's not. And as it turns out, depending on what you assume about the spin prior of this object, you can change your decision pretty easily this particular thing. If you allow it to be rapidly spinning or force it to be rapidly spinning, then you know it's perfectly consistent with a neutron star. However, if you say it can't possibly rapidly spinning, then it's, you know, pretty darn close to a black hole, and or it must be a black hole. It doesn't, you know, it's not 100% certain. It's like 95% certain that it's probably a black hole. The issue is, though, that the actual data is not informative for this spin parameter. So whatever you put in as a prior is what you're going to get out. So we quote some numbers in our paper on you different extremes of this. You can use things like universal relations from this Brew and Retzela paper to try to draw separatrices here, but again, dominated by your spin prior and whatever conclusion you make. So that's it. I'm out of time. I'm just going to flip to my references. So again, there's a lot of material here that I didn't have a chance to cover. In particular, these catalog papers are just a treasure trove of new results. But hopefully, you see that even, you know, as we learn new things, it's really just highlighting, you know, even just in small parts of the primary space in low mass, a lot of work that we can do. So I'm excited to sort of, you know, continue digging into these things as the data becomes public and see what everyone in the world has to think. I think that's, you know, one of the great things about the data becoming public. To that end, you can find all of the public release information, all the data for everything is public right here at this URL. So download it, you know, play around, publish. If you want to know more about specifically these papers up here, the first webinar starts tomorrow. Alternatively, you know, come back in about an hour and a half and we'll have a discussion in the strong gravity group meeting. But that's it. I'm right up against the hour, so I'm going to stop talking. Thank you all for listening. I'm happy to take questions now. I can stay around a little bit over the hour if people want, or contact me offline at any point. So thanks again. This was really fun. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it too.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Reed. Just to clarify for me, like, the gravity meeting is in half an hour, right?
Is it in? Yes, it's in,
yeah, it's in half an hour.
Okay, great. Yeah. Okay, cool. Any further questions for Reed?
I have a question regarding the data. Is it true that the maximum mass observed for neutron stars are pulsars is 2.15?
So that is
observational mass.
Yeah, let me apologize for flipping back through this so much stuff. The biggest star, pulsar, that we've seen, so what I made a point of emphasizing that to use this bit of information, you have to be very confident that the object you're observing is actually a neutron star. Otherwise, you know, it could be something else. The biggest neutron star that we're very confident that is actually a neutron star, it's the biggest object, is what is this Cromartie pulsar. It's 2.14 plus or minus 0.1. So it could be 2.24, it could be 2.04. Sort of the center is at 2.01 plus or minus 0.03 or something like that. So a little bit above 2 is where the biggest pulsars that we've observed like to live. And the important thing to remember is that's really just a lower bound. So just because we've only seen something that's big doesn't mean that is, you know, where the maximum mass could live. This maximum mass red line could live on the other side of this blue kink, and the universe could just not make neutron stars that go up to their maximum conceivable mass. So there's a little bit of a subtlety there, but yes, you are right. The biggest pulsars that we've seen are at 2.14.
From observation of it, because many neutron stars have been observed. So the question is, why would, if nature tells us it doesn't go above 2.14 or whatever, why would it expect it to occur? Why would it occur? This is what we see, so to speak.
Right. So it could be that the equation of state simply can't support anything above 2.14. But it could be that the equation of state can support things well above 2.14. And it's just that supernova physics or whatever formation channel tends not to make things above 2.14. Like, you know, the complications of neutrino transport in the exploding supernova or the bounce physics, all that stuff, just tends to produce a birth mass that truncates at 2.14. If we get enough data that we're really confidently starting to see that, and we can bound the biggest neutron star mass from a population analysis, then I think it is a very interesting question to answer, but you do have to keep these things in mind. Does that answer your question, John?
Yeah. Another question is an effective field theory. When you increase the size of the cutoff, 1 over m, it rapidly produces free parameters. So when we do the fitting to higher orders, how many free parameters do you have?
Yeah, so the, let me just go back up to the plots we can talk about. The difference of free parameters, I don't know the exact number of the coefficients that you additionally get when you use this higher order mode. To be clear, though, that those are not to the gravitational wave data by terrestrial experiments, and then we're extrapolating their uncertainty up here. The other thing I want to be clear about is we're not changing the momentum scale in the EFT calculations. So to say that another way, you're going to assume in the EFT that you're going to, you know, there's some large momentum scale over a small momentum scale, and whatever large momentum you pick, it's going to, you know, as you wiggle that, the renormalizing group will change your effective, you know, coupling coefficients, et cetera, et cetera. That's all true. But these two calculations, we're not wiggling that momentum scale. We're just changing when we stop believing the theory. So there are two separate things here. We're just picking these as example calculations. They're not an exhaustive set. So even if you took just this black prediction and then wiggled that momentum cutoff scale, or some of the other regulator things that they do to make their numerical calculation go, you would get slightly different theory predictions, different priors, which then would, you know, change how much you believe that this calculation is preferred by the data. The claim from the theorists is that those types of effects are sort of incorporated in their uncertainty bands from their prior, but we don't have I can't point you to a paper that shows this is unambiguously the case. There could be systematics in the theory calculation. That being said, if they were big and they disagreed with the data, we would be able to pick them up in this type of analysis and say, you know, something's wrong with the theory starting here.
Actually, John, so why don't we hold that for the gravity?
Yeah.
John, feel free to email me at any point if
yeah,
you want
to. Sorry to take your time. Nice talk.
No, interesting questions.
Okay, any last questions for Reed?
Maybe one. I was interested to see that plot closer to the beginning about there being some evidence for a peak around 40 solar masses due to parent stability supernovae, and I wonder how accurate the predicted peak of that plot of that what mass the peak is, how accurately that's predicted, because there's famously there's this other claimed mechanism to produce a peak or somewhere around there. I don't know the exact value, but due to a peak in primordial black holes being produced by the fact that there was a dip in the primordial as you go through the QCD phase transition, the QCD epoch, there's a dip at some moment in cosmic history, which if there were primordial black holes would lead to would naturally predict a peak in their production at roughly that mass. And that I suspect that primordial black hole calculation, they probably can't calculate the shape very well, because without knowing the shape of the primordial power spectrum, but they probably could make a rather specific prediction about where the peak is, because they know on fundamental physics grounds rather accurately where the primordial equation of state drops at what moment in cosmic history. And so it'd just be interesting if one could distinguish, if one could make a similarly accurate prediction for, or you know, an appropriately accurate prediction for the peak due to this parent stability supernova, and then try to test which one is preferred by the data. I don't know, have you thought about that at all, or do you know what the prospects are?
But that's a very interesting point. I will say that my understanding of the literature is that the parent stability feature is, I mean, it does depend on metallicity and sort of the types of stars that you have going into it. But typically it's predicted to within like plus or minus 5. When you assume a certain description for everything, you can actually tighter, but then uncertainties in different numerical modeling schemes and or metallicity of progenitor stars basically puff that up to like plus or minus 5. So I don't know anything about the BBH. The uncertainty in the peak parameters from here is like plus or minus 5 or 10, uh-huh. Maybe a little. But you should also look at. Sorry, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
That's the observational uncertainty, you mean?
Exactly, and uh-huh. If you look at the different models that are chosen, they do fluctuate. Like one is at like 38 plus or minus 7, and the other is like at 33 plus or minus 8. Or something like that. So there's a little bit of modeling systematics that you can see between different assumptions. And the overall trend is, you know, we're seeing something. So the statement is, yeah, we've seen clear evidence that there's something there. But if you wanted to say, I know it's 35 instead of 45, the data is probably not there yet. Interesting uh-huh. to look at, but probably.
But maybe eventually it will be.
Yeah. I mean, that's the hope.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, so why don't we stop here? So Reed will be around at the gravity meeting for any further questions.